From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. As Earth Week begins, No Impact Man, Colin Bevan, talks about what's behind his effort to reduce our collective footprint.
The point is not consumerism with the hope that some good will come out of it, but we actually just say, let's do the good things.
Plus, what's kept legendary marathoner Catherine Switzer lacing up her running shoes since she was 12 years old.
That sense of magic actually has stayed with me for 55 years of running. It's like a day I don't run is just like the day I don't have a bonus. And the day I do run is the day I've got the magic. And I want to pass that on to everybody.
And cartoonist Keith Knight talks about his long-running autobiographical comic and his latest project, the hilarious drawings in a new kids' book based on comedian Craig Robinson's life story. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Next Saturday will signal the 47th annual celebration of Earth Day. And all this week we're using that commemoration, which was the brainchild of Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson, to focus on signs of concern and hope for our habitat. We'll start today with the perspective of Colin Bevan.
The Brooklyn-based writer and blogger funneled his concerns about climate change into action, starting with a year-long attempt to have zero impact on his environment. He chronicled the experiment in a book called No Impact Man, which later became a documentary. Time magazine ranked his online presence among the world's top 15 environmental websites.
Bevan visited Milwaukee last week to share his story at UWM as the university kicked off a week-long effort to waste and consume less. Lake Effect's Susan Bent sat down with Bevan, who said he started out neither as an environmentalist nor an activist. Bevan says it started for him years ago with concerns about climate change and the Iraq War.
Well, actually, what happened was I was angry. I was angry. First of all, I was angry at what we did for oil. Over 3,000 American troops dead, over 100,000 Iraqis dead. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on now, pretty much everybody agrees it was a war for oil to have an American footprint in the Middle East. So I was upset about that. I was upset about climate change, that actually burning of the self-same oil was causing us to degrade the ability of our habitat to support us as a species. And I was upset about the way of life in between, that 27% of Americans at any one time could be diagnosed with depression or major anxiety disorder. So we were like wrecking the place and not having a party doing it. And I wanted to write some sort of a book, you know, chastising it. Don't you realize what you're doing to the world? And one day, a hot summer's day, I was thinking about what book I would write. And I came into my apartment in New York, and it was boiling hot in the corridor of my apartment building. I opened the door to my apartment, and this frigid air came out because I had left both air conditioners on all day long because I didn't want to have to wait 20 minutes for my apartment to cool down. And I had this moment where I thought about that. I thought, if we're in a war for energy, basically, where people are dying for energy, and I'm wasting that energy by just letting my air conditioners run all day long with no one home, what does that say about me? Because people are actually dying for that energy. And in that moment, I had this idea where if I wanted to attract public attention, if I wanted to contribute to that, to climate change and what I call a crisis in our way of life, that maybe I should actually write a story about my changing and my doing something about it instead of a finger-wagging story about how everybody should do it.
So at that point in your life, you were on your own, or did you have a family?
Yeah, I was married to my now co-parent, Michelle, and I had a little girl, Isabella, who was at that time 1.5, and a dog, Frankie. Frankie sadly's passed. Together, I called us 10 legs and a tail.
So you and your partner sat down and set up a framework?
We took 1 month at a time to figure out a different area of our life. So the first month was not buying anything new. If we were going to buy clothes, where would we buy them secondhand? Or buy anything, electronics, where would we buy anything secondhand? So no buying anything new was the first month. We kind of leaned into that and learned how to do it. I remember one time it was my daughter's birthday, and we found this secondhand children's store. We told her, you can have anything you want. And she found this pair of silver slippers. They were $1.50, and that's what she wanted for her birthday in this secondhand store. It was so sweet. The second month was learning how not to make trash. So that meant no buying any food in packaging, no buying anything in packaging. So no yogurt, no milk in a carton. We found a place where we could buy milk in returnable glass bottles where the farmer reused the bottles. Or if we bought cheese, I brought my own cheesecloth to the farmer's market. And meanwhile, still not buying anything new. And then from there to sustainable transportation. No transportation of any kind that used fossil fuels, which meant not even mass transit. Not that I'm against mass transit, but this was an experiment in trying to reduce our impact as much as possible. So only walking and biking, basically. Then the next month was only local food. The next month was sustainable energy use, which meant we actually ended up turning off the electricity in our apartment because there was no way to really get sustainable electricity, sustainable water use, and then giving back. And then once we'd been through those months, then we had 6 months left where we just lived all of it for the remaining 6 months of the year.
So what was toughest?
The toughest was that I ended up having to wash our clothes by hand. What we would do is we would throw the dirty clothes in the bathtub and laundry soap, and we would stomp it. Like, you know, like in the olden, we used to call it Grape Stomper's Laundry Day because it was like as though we were stomping grapes for wine. In fact, in the movie No Impact Man, there's a scene where the three of us, my daughter Isabella and my co-parent Michelle, are stomping the laundry and we're all laughing. So when people say what was the hardest, it's really interesting because we imagine that all our modern conveniences make our lives easier. But actually, there's a law in economics that the more efficient you become, the more efficient you have to be. We don't get a laundry machine and then luxuriate in the free time of not having to wash our clothes by hand. We get a laundry machine, and then we find ourselves working harder during the time we would have been doing our laundry to make the money for the laundry machine. And the same with the microwave, and the same with the electric dishwasher. Everybody says what was harder about living environmentally, but in fact, there were a lot of things that were way better. We got rid of our TV, which meant we spent more time with each other as a family and with our friends. Because of the local food element, we always had a big pot of homemade soup in the fridge. Our friends would come over and eat our good food, and then we'd play charades. Instead of watching TV, we'd relate to each other. We'd spend time with each other. On hot days, when there was no air conditioning, we would go to Washington Square Park, and my daughter Isabella would play in the fountain. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating a return to 19th century living. What I am saying is that as a people, as a society, I think we've lost sight of our human priorities. Like what actually makes our lives good? Because we've gotten to this stage where we're working and working and working to get stuff. We're working for the conveniences that allow us to work, you know. We're on the work-to-spend treadmill. And that same consumerist work-to-spend treadmill, which degrades our own happiness, is degrading our planet's ability to support us. But the part I think that's most important, which I came to embrace during the year, which is that each of us actually makes a difference. Like, we can be engaged in our societies, and I think we're seeing that now in the United States more. People are starting, are beginning to become engaged in their society in a new way, and we can be engaged in both in terms of how we choose to live our lives, you know, that maybe we choose to have the type of life, you know, and hope that our cities will embrace a way of planning the design of the city that allows for active transportation as opposed to requiring us all to have cars. Because let's not forget that actually to own a car costs the average American $12,000 a year. So we're back to working to get the car so that you can get to work, right? Whereas we could have a way of life where we lived near to each other and walked and biked and actually got exercise. Because cars are also, the research shows, responsible for obesity, partly responsible in the United States. But the big thing for me has been that I've realized that I have the power to change my life and the life of others. The lives of others. And you know, I'm here in Wisconsin to give a talk to students, and basically that's what I'll be talking about, how these students also have the power to choose how they want to live their lives, that they do not have to choose to be part of the work-to-spend treadmill. They can instead choose lives of meaning and purpose, and that they are capable of shaping their lives and shaping the society that they live in a way that's better for all of us.
So not so many years ago, you ran for the House of Representatives. What led to that moment, and would you consider it again?
You know, I just at the moment, the climate movement is finally saying we should be running for office. You know, I just read a tweet by Bill McKibben, actually, where he said, if you're running for office, and you should be, et cetera, et cetera. Back in 2012, I had that thought that we should, activists tend to stand outside the political system and try to push against it rather than actually invading the political system and attempting to subvert it. So I ran in 2012 with absolutely no chance of winning because I ran as a Green Party candidate in something like a 92% Democratic stronghold. There was never a chance that I would win. But because it was a Democratic stronghold, the Democratic candidate didn't spend any time in his constituency talking to his electors. He was around campaigning for other people around the country. In other words, the Democrats just took this area for granted. You know, you have nowhere else to go, so we're not going to pay attention to you. So my run for Congress was actually an attempt to, well, first to model to the climate movement that we could be running for seats and having conversations and expanding the conversation and understanding the connections. And the connection is very clear in my mind because war for oil equals over 50% military budget, means no money for education and housing, means unfair and unequal economic system, and equals climate change. So that actually these connect, which all, for me, connect around, again, the consumer economy, the idea that the way that we do well is by digging resources out of the ground, molding them into a product, hoping that people will buy them, and then throw them away and buy a new version of them as soon as possible, then burying them in another hole in the ground. That actually there's a way of being where instead of thinking health or education or housing is the spin-off of this consumerism, that we actually address ourselves directly to those things and say, the point is not consumerism with the hope that some good will come out of it, but we actually just say, let's do the good things.
So I was going to ask if in your work, if there's an individual or a place or time of somebody embracing or having an aha moment with this no impact or low impact philosophy, but I guess I would shift that to ask, do you feel that you're making headway among people who are not already in some way either concerned, enlightened?
I mean, I think two things to say. First of all, I think everybody's concerned. In another part of my life, I teach meditation. And part of my job as a teacher is that I sit and I do interviews, and consult what we call consulting interviews, where students come in to ask questions about their practice and, you know, maybe talk about some life problems. We talk about how the practice of mindfulness can be used to help with whatever their situation is. And person after person after person is coming in to discuss anxiety. So it's not that people aren't aware or don't think people are, something's wrong. If you go, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you see, if you go and you think, everybody raise your hand who thinks the world and our government is working correctly. Nobody raises their hand, or maybe two or three people who want to be a bit rebellious say so. There's no problem with people seeing that there's a problem. The question is getting some sort of consensus around the nexus or the location of the problem. Well, I'll tell you about a conversation. I was giving a talk in Washington, D.C., and I said, it's ridiculous that we spend 51 weeks a year working our rear ends off so that on the 52nd week of the year, we can take our families to Disney World. And somebody raised her hand and she said, but I like going to Disney World. And I said, well, yes, I understand that. She said, it's the only time I get to spend with my children. And I said, well, I understand that. And I would never take that away from you under the current system. But what if we had a system where you as a mom could actually spend time with your kids during the year? Would you give up Disney World if you could spend, you know, 20 hours a week with your kids every week? And she was like, more or less, you're trying to take Disney World away. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not trying to take, I'm trying to see if I can offer you something better. She argued with me for a little while. And then finally I said, for some reason, we're not connecting. And so I said to her, I said, I think, you know, I have to leave it to you that you prefer 1 week in Disney World and I prefer 51 weeks, you know, 52 weeks with my kids. And she said, wait, you're saying during the year we spend time with our kids and we don't just spend time with the 1 week? And I said, yeah, that's what I'm saying. She said, oh, she said, I agree with you. But the idea that we could live differently was such a stretch of imagination from her, because she had worked so hard in her life to give her children just to scratch out that 1 week a year. Like that imagining that we could actually not be working our rear ends off in that way, that we could return to our human values is a stretch for people. So sometimes it's hard to get people to agree because it's beyond their imagining, right? The second thing I'll say on your point is that in terms of social change, we don't have to get everybody to agree with us. All we really have to do, and there's enough, I believe, there's enough people who actually agree with us, all we really have to do is convince the people who agree with us that they make a difference, that they'll make a change if they get involved.
Environmental writer Colin Bevan speaking with Lake Effect Susan Bentz. As you'd expect, Bevan flew in from New York for his appearance in Milwaukee. He did tell Lake Effect Susan Bentz he has maintained pieces of his year-long attempt at zero waste.
I mean, what I say is that I'm no longer no impact man. I'm now medium impact man.
You'll find out more about his work at WUWM.com. Bevan is the beginning of a week of stories pegged to Earth Week.
Keep listening. With the Boston Marathon underway, Catherine Switzer recounts the story of her first Boston Marathon 50 years ago when officials tried to drag her off the race course. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You might not be familiar with the name Catherine Switzer today, unless you're into American running history, but Switzer is directly or indirectly responsible for the careers of many of the sport's luminaries, from Paula Radcliffe to Joan Benoit Samuelson.
Switzer was the first woman to compete in a marathon. 50 years ago, on April 19th, she was assigned a bib for the 1967 Boston Marathon race under the name K.V. Switzer. When officials discovered a woman was competing, they tried to literally pull her off the course. Her boyfriend intervened, and she went on to finish the race. And in the time since, she has become a tireless advocate for women and girls in the sport. She went on to win the New York Marathon when women were finally permitted to compete. We spoke with her last spring when she was in Milwaukee to speak at an event held by Girls on the Run organization. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's great to meet you and be here, too.
Why running? Let's take it back to when you first started. Before we talk about all the things you've done for women and girls in the United States particularly, but around the world, what was it about running that grabbed you?
It grabbed me at age 12, if you can imagine this. My dad said, honey, if you ran a mile a day, you'd make that field hockey team in your high school. And I, you know, was insecure and skinny and frizzy hair and, you know, how some things never change. And he started me running this mile a day. And he said it wasn't about going fast. It was just finishing. And what happened is I got really in very good shape by running this mile a day. But also I got empowered. I had this sort of magic weapon, this secret thing that nobody could take away from me, a victory. And it made me really powerful and strong. And so for a prepubescent kid going into high school, it was astonishing how self-possessed I felt and what a great moral compass I had. And that sense of magic actually has stayed with me for 55 years of running. It's like a day I don't run is just like the day I don't have a bonus. And the day I do run is the day I've got the magic. And I want to pass that on to everybody.
What is it about running, do you think, that empowers girls in particular, but everybody, because this is pretty equal opportunity?
Let me say this. It's astonishing that it is a transformational experience. What we've witnessed now in the United States, for instance, is 57% of all the runners are women. That's huge. That's a social revolution. And what it is several things. One, it's easy, convenient, and cheap. And it provides this transformational experience, which may be both chemical and also psychological, from the point of view that when you cover a distance and you've only got 20 minutes in your day to do it, you come back saying, I've accomplished something today. So, you know, put another brick in the wall and I'm building up to a marathon or I'm just helping my life. So that sense of empowerment is tremendous. We're also discovering that there are real chemical reasons why this happens, and in women perhaps more than men. And that is that we're releasing all kinds of calming effects, serotonins, you know, drug-like chemicals.
The feel-good chemical.
The feel-good.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the endorphins are surging all day, and it makes you feel like you can get anything done. I think the other thing is It's so time efficient for women that in a busy day when you're getting ready for work and you've got three kids and you've got the dog in the house and everybody's running around and you've got that 20 minutes, you can just squeeze in something that gives you your sense of self. You just that moment when you can focus and become yourself.
So what about for girls who haven't got the dog and the kids yet and all of those things? What does it do to that prepubescent body that is just about to change?
It's phenomenal, and that's why Girls on the Run is so important, because these young girls, let's say between 9 and 13, are going through one of the biggest transitions in their lives, and they lose their natural sense of security and strength because they're getting hit with all kinds of images and other behaviors and messages. But if they run and they socialize with each other, they associate this feel-good with each other, they learn lessons in how to work as a community, and they also feel empowered. So they have that same sense that I described at age 12 going forward. I think it's really, really important for them because they can then, you know, plan their lives and make an easy decision on behaviors. It's been tremendous.
Yeah, I remember that time not terribly fondly. I think most of us look back at that 12, 13 transition time, younger now.
Grim.
as a really grim time and a really difficult time. And one of those things where everything is changing. You don't know where the ground isn't shifting. And you feel all of those hormones are surging. You just don't know what's going on. And I wish I had had running at that time.
Absolutely. I look back and say, if I'd had Girls on the Run, I just wonder what I would have become, you know, even more. But the fact is that they have a community to talk to. And I understand from the Girls on the Run leaders, their coaches, that they ask questions of other girls and to their leaders that they don't ask at home. And I think it's really, really great that they have a place to go with those issues. Sometimes you're so burdened and you just want to ask the question and you don't know where to turn.
Do they know who you are in terms of the Boston Marathon and all of the work you've done to help support women and girls?
You know what's fun is they're briefed on me before I get there. And I always worry, used to worry, that, oh, my gosh, they're going to think I'm old as Methuselah.
But they probably do.
I am. But the reality is for a 12-year-old, anybody who's over 15 is old. So I'm home and host, you know. But they love the story. And they love the story of a girl who wanted to run and was told she couldn't run and, in fact, was attacked in a race because I was a girl. They loved that story because I went ahead and did it anyway and showed that I was fearless. And they want to be like that. They want to say, I can do anything. And that's the message I want them to have.
So when you look back at 1967, which is when you were attacked at the Boston Marathon for daring to run, And fast forward now to 2016, what has changed and what hasn't?
You know, imagine this. It's 1967. I'm only 20. I've trained hard for the marathon. I've done the distance, more than the distance in practice. It was a reward from my coach who was very proud of me. So he helped me register for the race. That was the issue. I wasn't the first woman to run a marathon or even Boston, but I was the first woman to wear a bib number in a major event like that. And it was captured by the press truck who went by us when an official jumped off the official's bus and attacked me and tried to throw me out of the race because I was wearing a bib number. And he tried to pull the bib number off of me because women weren't allowed. And my boyfriend hit the official. The official went out of the race. I went on to finish. Okay, so it's funny in the retelling, except for the fact that I made that decision at 20 to finish the race. I probably wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't started running when I was 12 years old and had the sense of confidence and the sense of that I can do anything. What has happened after that is immediately after, it was very polarizing. People said, I shouldn't have been there. That's a terrible thing for you to do. Other people put my picture up on their mantelpiece and wrote me these love letters, you know, said, this is fantastic. The point is this, is that the wedge was there. It became global news, and it also inspired me. And I often say to people, sometimes the worst things in your life can become the best things because it gives you inspiration to change, or I could have walked off the course and left it behind me and become a bitter person. Instead, I realized other women would run if they only had opportunities. So I began building events to make those opportunities happen. What has happened since then has been nothing short of a social revolution. Other other women, of course, in their hundreds and thousands have become involved. And what has happened is people, women, have begun running not to lose weight anymore, not to be an Olympic athlete, but to have that sense of accomplishment every day. And they are empowered. They're spreading the word to each other. And in the United States, as I said before, 57% of all the runners in North America are women. And it's because it's an empowerment movement. What is lacking is that this same huge equality is not happening in other sports yet in the United States. We're seeing inequality in soccer, in basketball, in softball, in professional sports in general, not so much in tennis, although there's still rumblings there. The point is this, is that the men in running always helped the women in running a lot. It was equality from the get-go. Men felt it's not that we're males, females, it's gender-free. And I would have loved to see that happen in soccer and other sports. It's coming along as more and more women stake their claim for what they deserve, when they stake their claim for equal prize money. But it's the same in the marketplace. I mean, we have to keep staking our claim for equal pay in the workplace as well, and childcare, and a lot of things that many other industrialized countries have that we do not have. On the other hand, you know, we're leading the world, I think, now in sports for sure. What's really truly lacking, though, are parts of the world where women can't even go out of the house, can't get a passport, not allowed to drive, not allowed to get an education, not allowed to have their faces shown. And we're working on ways now to use running, even virtually, for them to join a women's community and have that sense of power where they can start doing social change in their own countries. However, let me say this. Running has worked before, and it'll work again. And running works with every woman every time. It's amazing. This, whatever, it's chemical, it's empowerment, it's transformational. Freedom also begins in the heart. And I think sometimes you just need to know you're not alone out there. And if you can communicate with somebody else who has a sense of fearlessness and you're fearful, you can start deriving strength and inspiration from that. And it will begin small. But let's just say that when women get together, when they form their communities, they're very, very powerful. And they also have weapons now. I shouldn't use such a militaristic term, but the weapon is the internet and the weapon is cell phone. It's cell technology. And they can communicate with each other. And they will. And we've seen revolutions in the Mideast because of cellular technology.
Because people could text.
Excellent. Absolutely.
It's great that all of these opportunities exist now for girls in the schools. Title IX happened in the early 70s, a lot of it coming out of what was going on in the 60s. And so we've created an atmosphere where it's assumed that girls will have the same opportunities as boys. What happens, though, when they leave school? That's where it seems to me that, again, we touched on it just a bit, where it's lacking, where there's no professional or very few professional opportunities for women who are good enough to take it into the professional realm. So how do we fix that?
Okay, there's several things. First of all, let's go back to how these girls grow up with no sense of limitation, which is utterly fabulous and what Girls on the Run is all about. I was watching a mother show her daughter the picture of me getting thrown out of the Boston Marathon, the attempted throw out of the Boston Marathon. And she said, that man's trying to throw her out because she's a girl. And she said, why? And she said, well, because she's a girl. And the little girl looked at her mother and she said, why? She didn't get it. And I said, that's what it's all about. That is really what it's all about. All right. So now these young girls have grown up with no sense of limitation. They have the opportunities in the schools, thanks to Title IX. They have full scholarships at universities, thanks to Title IX. Now what happens after they have run track for a big university or played on the team and they don't have a professional opportunity? They're really left in limbo. Absolutely. But I'm saying, ladies, come on. You know, you've got all the smarts. You've had the scholarship. Get together and do two things. One, create community programs. First of all, not everybody's going to be a professional athlete. Let's look at the NFL. How many players from my alma mater, Syracuse University? I mean, they've got like 90 guys on a scholarship. And how many of them actually go to the NFL? About four. you know, and that's probably big. So what happens to all the rest of them? Well, you know, they're now sports management classes. They should be learning stadium management. They should be learning marketing, sports. They could be sports therapists, sports lawyers, sports physicians. All kinds of opportunities now in sports exist. On the other hand, they also should keep up their own sports and fitness. And I live a number of months a year in New Zealand, and we don't really have that many professional sports there. But what we have is astonishing amounts of community teams where, for instance, women after work, instead of going like to the bowling league, they go out and they play rugby or they play field hockey, and it's Wellington versus Auckland versus Christchurch. They have those community teams, and they take them very seriously. It's like small leagues. Why do we drop it all after college? Why don't we form in our own communities? If you love soccer, why don't you form a community soccer team? I think women would love to do it. They take their kids to soccer, and then they could go play their own game. So then in terms of the professional ranks, you could then start forming farm teams. You could start forming B leagues and go out and get your sponsors. So you should use your skills that you've learned as an athlete and parlay that into going forward. Also, you're learning how to be close to the sport you love and also earn a living doing it, or at least have a passion. It's amazing what can happen. I just love people to think a little bit more out of the box.
So looking forward now, you know, you've spent the last 50 years doing great things for girls and women through sports, through running. Are you positive about what's happening?
Boy, am I ever positive. You know, just at the point when you think you're going to write another book and go plant some petunias and slow down a little bit, things happen. Over the transom, my old bib number 261 from the Boston Marathon that the official tried to pull off of me suddenly has become this magic number, meaning fearless in the face of adversity. And to cut a long story short, it grew so fast, so organically, we've created a nonprofit from this where we're going to start doing a global series of clubs, training programs, and creating the broader community of women globally. You know, we saw what it did with organizing races. Now, if we could create the community of clubs and friendships like a Girls on the Run for grown-up women, we've created 261 Fearless Inc. nonprofit, and we're reaching out to those women in the Mideast and North Africa, and we have the power of the internet behind us. So that's going to be very, very, very exciting. But I think the future is going to be that women are going to become so, I don't want to use the word addicted, but let's say involved with their own sense of movement and accomplishment through fitness, through movement, through running, if you will, because it's cheap and easy, but other activities, that they're not going to leave it behind. And they're going to embrace it, and they're going to spread the word to their friends and maybe most importantly to their daughters, because now we're seeing the second, third generation of women who've grown up running every morning and their kids have watched them go out the door and it's part of their lifestyle. So they're going to have a wonderful role model and a wonderful image of women's accomplishment going forward.
And here's to many, many more years of it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Switzer was the first woman to compete in the Boston Marathon 50 years ago. She was instrumental in getting the International Olympic Committee to add women's marathon as a sport back in 1984, paving the way for American Joan Benoit to win that first race.
We spoke with Switzer last spring. This year's Boston Marathon is today. Wednesday is the 50th anniversary of Switzer's historic Boston Marathon run, and she is competing again today.
One last break, and then another person trying to break the mold. Illustrator Keith Knight talks about the importance of African-American characters in his work. When Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Cartoonist Keith Knight juggles a lot of deadlines. He's the creator of not one, not two, but three different comic strips, The Knight Life, Think, with Inc. in parentheses, and the K Chronicles. They all straddle the line between what we consider mainstream and underground comics. But the last strip in that list is a weekly semi-autobiographical strip that's allowed him to share his distinctive view of the world, that of a middle-aged African-American cartoonist.
But his latest project is based on someone else's semi-autobiographical work, comedian Craig Robinson, who's acted in everything from the TV show The Office to the movie Hot Tub Time Machine, co-authored the new kid's book, Jake the Fake Keeps It Real, along with writer Adam Mansbach. It's about a sixth grader dealing with imposter syndrome in his first year at an arts magnet school. Keith Knight did the illustrations, and that brought him to Milwaukee recently and the Lake Effect Studio as well. Thanks for being here.
I am happy to be here. I'm psyched because one of the things is WUWM sounds almost like WMWM, which is my college radio station in Salem, Massachusetts, Salem State University.
Well, I'm so glad we could make that happen. I wanted to start maybe by doing something a little experimental. We might organize this interview in a way I don't think I've done before. If you look at the bottom of a Wikipedia page, it has a whole bunch of categories that people are listed under. And I wanted to do a little rapid fire, maybe not so rapid fire, asking you about some of these categories, starting with 1966 births.
Oh, yes, 1966 births.
I won't ask you about 1966 in particular, but let me ask you how old you were when drawing became a big deal for you.
I remember drawing as little as kindergarten, which was probably, 4 years old? But I know I drew before that. I know I drew on a lot of walls in my apartment. But I remember being praised for my dinosaurs in kindergarten. So that's the earliest that I recall. But I've always drawn. So I've got some artists on my dad's side of the family. My dad is a pretty neat illustrator. We spent a lot of time drawing the leaves on trees. Like, we'd draw trees and draw all the little leaves. And then my great uncle was a great painter. And he, you know, he couldn't get into Mass College of Art because of the color of his skin. And but he spent some time in Paris and I was just talking about it earlier. He got stabbed in a bar in Paris. and they weren't stabbing him. They were stabbing someone else, but they sort of missed and hit my uncle. But he gave me the thirst for travel and art at the same time.
All right, so jumping away from the Wikipedia organization for just a minute here, where did you enter the creative process with Jake the Fake?
I was approached early on by Adam Mansbach, who's a friend of mine. We met each other when I lived in San Francisco. And we met each other at we both spoke in this class, and we realized just how much we had in common. We're both from Boston, both big Red Sox fans. We were both rappers in live bands and stuff like that. We just had so much in common and sort of just bonded over that. And at some point, we knew we were going to work together at some point. And he had his, you know, his big hit with the Go to F to Sleep, which was a Facebook post. It started out as a Facebook post. I remember that exact Facebook post and people going, oh, you should make that into a book. But he contacted me. He said, hey, Keith, you know, I got this idea for this new book series. And it's based on Craig Robinson's time as a kid playing keyboards and sort of discovering, finding his calling. And so, you know, I was wondering if you want to do some sample illustrations. We'll do a sample chapter. So he sent me a chapter and I illustrated it. And like, it was a fierce bidding war between companies. And we got a 3-book deal. And it was like exactly how you would hope it would happen. And so then he and Craig collaborated on it. And I just got sent the transcript, the manuscript. And he, you know, they're really good with, like, letting me just do my thing. I showed some character designs, and they said, okay, well, you know, I think originally I wanted to do teachers and model them after all these different comedians. But I think we would have ran into some issues with, you know, the comedians. So we stayed away from that. But pretty much, yeah, I was pretty much hands off. And I mean, they were pretty much hands off, I should say. And I just did my thing.
as you say, this is really Craig's story. But at the same time, there's a lot in the book about finding the thing that you're good at that I imagine would resonate with you, too.
Oh, certainly so. I mean, there's a lot of things that resonate with me with the book, but definitely finding your calling. I've always knew what I wanted to do. I just didn't know how I'd get there. So I always knew. But I had a twin sister who didn't know what she wanted to do. So she's done everything. And in some ways, I admire all the different experiences she's had. She's opened up a tea shop. She worked at a zoo, although I worked at a zoo, too. But she is now a yoga instructor, and I think she's found her calling.
Also on the list, people from Malden, Massachusetts. We know you're from Massachusetts. You did not know there was a Wikipedia category, people from Malden, Massachusetts.
I sort of kind of did, and I was disappointed to see that I wasn't on there at one point. But it's home to Killer Kowalski's wrestling school. Jack Albertson from Chico and the Man is from there. And then Gary Cherone, who's the lead singer of Extreme, is from there. And both myself and Gary Cherone were part of the inaugural class of the Malden High School Hall of Fame. So from a few years ago. So I'm very proud to say that.
Well, I was also going to ask, the Boston area in the 60s and 70s was not always noted for its racial harmony. What was the community like for you growing up?
Well, Boston is known as the South of the North. But there's that iconic photo of like a black lawyer being stabbed with an American flag over the busing issue. But I grew up in Malden was very working class. I grew up in the black section of Malden, and it was just sort of as diverse as it's going to be, blacks and whites, Jews. Yeah, I thought it was a wonderful place to live. In fact, I just did a comic strip about I had a recommendation from Facebook to be a friend of the liquor store that was across the street from my apartment. And it just triggered this weird but pleasant memory of my parents giving me money to go across the street to the liquor store and get them two packages of Benson and Hedges. I was age seven with matches, and then just coming back across the street and counting all the little mini bottles of booze on the ground. And I just thought, for some reason, it was like a sentimental thing. And of course, I posted it. Those of you who lived in a certain part of Malden, and then like all these people like, yeah, Vernon's Liquors. And it's just, that's the great thing about doing these autobiographical comics, especially I've been doing it for 25 years. I have this history that I can pass down to my kids. Like, if you wonder why your father beat you, this is the reason. No, I'm just joking. I only beat my children in chess. That's it. Because they're the only ones I can beat. My wife wipes me out. Anyway, but I think it's a really neat thing. And I didn't realize that, recording this history is going to be a neat thing to pass down generation.
I was going to ask if you had such a heady thought in mind when you started doing that.
Certainly not. What I did with the K Chronicles, I came up with the K Chronicles in the early 90s as an answer to what I saw was this misrepresentation of hip hop fans. Everybody was saying, oh, you listen to hip hop, you're a thug, you're in a gang, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that does not reflect anything that any of my friends were into hip hop, and we're not. We have jobs, we go to college, we're into politics, we're into other music, we're, nerdy, we're all different types of things. So it was important for me to put that out there. And it totally, I knew that it would be a success. I didn't realize how big of a success it would be. I didn't realize I'd be doing it 25 years later. But it's turned out to be this wonderful thing to sort of check in on and reflect on, and it's everything that all the success I have now has been a result of that comic strip.
Do you think the element of explaining, I don't know if explaining is the right word, but do you think the element of showing the other side of hip hop is that not as big a part of the equation anymore? I mean, there are a lot of people that have made that case in the 25 years since.
I don't think it necessarily needs to be my story now because, frankly, hip hop is a young person's music, and like, I still dig Public Enemy and Tribe Called Quest, which you know. It's great that they put out this last album and they got on Saturday Night Live. But, you know, how many 20, 25-year old hip-hop groups make it onto Saturday Night Live now? It's barely impossible. But it's barely possible, I should say. But I think it's someone else's story to tell. But, you know, my story now is really part of its fatherhood. You know, the examine fatherhood, but part of it, I think, also when you get to be my age, is history is really sort of putting things in context. Because now that I think you don't start thinking about history too much until you hit like 30, and then you're like, holy crap, like I think 3 decades just went by really fast, and you realize, like, oh my goodness, like I was born in the 60s, like, wow, like. All these people were assassinated in the 60s and like there was lynching in the 60s and all this different stuff. And you start to realize like things happening over and over again. And, you know, this idea that, oh, yeah, let's do tax cuts for the rich. That will fuel the economy. And then you realize, well, we did that. We did that a couple of times and it doesn't work. And also you just start to realize like, wow, okay. You know, if 30 years isn't that long, 50 years is not that long. 100 years is nothing. You know, we have people that are 100 years old. So when people sit there and tell me, oh, you know, when I talk about race issues and tie them back to slavery and stuff, like, oh, slavery happened a long time ago. You know, one of the big lines I say during my slideshow is like, how would you react if someone said, like, you know, get over it. Jesus was a long time ago. Get over it. Like, they'd be totally offended, right? and so it's just like when you open a Black History Museum in D.C. and you open it with a woman whose dad was born a slave, that's not that long ago. And we need to acknowledge that a lot of this stuff resonates now. A lot of the stuff that happened then resonates now, and we need to tie it. We're always looking forward. But if we don't look back, we'll make the same mistakes over and over again. And that's one of the biggest issues that America, biggest problem that America has, I think.
How old are your kids?
8 and 4.
Do you at some level still have to be an optimist about the world they're growing up in?
No. Maybe.
I mean, in a certain way.
Well, here's... We homeschool our kids. And one of the reasons why we decided to homeschool our kids, one is we moved to North Carolina. And despite outward appearances, North Carolina is rather progressive when it comes to homeschooling. And one of the reasons why I'm totally psyched about homeschooling is I don't have to teach my kids the BS history of America. I get to teach them. I'm not going to totally depress them about stuff, but I'm going to say, like, you know, there are people in this country that, for some strange reason, think people that look like us are inferior to them. And this has gone on for a long time. And the problem is, you know, I basically try to teach in a different way than what people say. So when people say, oh, you know, Black people have accomplished a lot, like, look, you have a first Black president. You know, I look at that as a white accomplishment because there have been plenty of Black people that have been qualified for president. It's just that white people would never vote for them. So I think white people have progressed to the point where they would allow a Black person to be president. So white people, congratulate yourselves. you've come around. You know, you've backtracked a bit, but you came around. And so it's those type of things. You know, the greatest thing in the world is the fact that my kids came into this world with a Black president. So, like, automatically, like, the president is you know, it's weird to see a white president. That is wild in and of itself. But, like, you can take everything away Obama accomplished, but the one thing you can't take away is the fact that he was there and my kids saw that when they were born. So,
Well, and let me ask a strange and potentially awkward question. But, you know, so I was sitting down and reading this.
Embrace the awkward.
You know, I'm totally with you. I was reading this book with my 8-year-old the other day, and it never once came up what color the protagonist was. Should that matter as a white reader?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I like the fact that you can look at this and just be able to identify with the lead character. You know, it shouldn't be that. You know, it'd be interesting to sort of touch on that issue, maybe here and there at some point. But I like the fact that, you know, there are some stuff that is about that and some stuff that's not about it. I just know that visually, it's super important. I talk to kids all the time about this in schools, how important it was. I had this one substitute teacher that was an aspiring cartoonist. All he did was teach a study class. But the fact that he was up there doodling and he looked like me made me say, I could do that. That, you know, that's something that I could possibly do. And that, I think white people don't understand the value in that because they've always seen themselves represented all the time, you know. And for me, it's either, you know, an entertainer, you know, singer, or an athlete. You know, that's all you see. Or mugshots all the time. Mugshots all the time. You look online for anything, you will just see a mugshot. If you look up black teenager and white teenager, you'll see white teens going to the mall, skateboarding. You see black teenager, you just see mugshots.
So where does Jake the Fake come in this dynamic? Is it a start to change things?
Yeah. Oh, no. I don't fully expect. I will say this. I got a Facebook post by somebody from my college, maybe like last year. And she said that 20 years ago or whatever, 25 years, I can't remember, in school, she said a joke that was a racist joke. And she said, I called her out on it. And I explained to her why it wasn't funny. And that was, and she said, I did it in a way, I didn't get mad, I didn't just, but I explained to her. She said that resonated with her. And she said, she said it changed her thinking. And she has a kid now. And she said she didn't realize how much that meant to her until she had her own kid. And frankly, I don't remember that interaction at all. I was probably stoned. And I don't but the fact that that little thing, and we can all do that. We can call people out on stuff. We can point people out to, why don't you check out this book? Like it's, you know, like all these little tiny things. Not one thing will solve these things, but all these little things will add up to progress. And that's what I'm trying to do with my work and with the work I recommend of others and with, you know, radio station shows like yourself.
Well, I hope we'll have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I totally appreciate it.
Keith Knight is the illustrator of the new kids book series, Jake the Fake. The first title in the series is just out. It's called Jake the Fake Keeps It Real. The books are written by Craig Robinson and Adam Monsbach.
Knight is also the cartoonist behind three syndicated strips, The Nightlife, Think, and the semi-autobiographical K Chronicles. You can find out lots more about him from links at WUWN.com.
Can I kick it?
That's all for Monday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Dyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.
Can I kick it to all the people who can quest like a tribe does? Before this, did you really know what I was?